Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now here is Doug with our first story from the Quad City Times.
And thank you, Dale. There are story here at the top of the page is justices rule in Trump's favor. It's kind of a national story about court rejects attempts to remove him from ballots over Capitol riot. I'm going to skip that story and go right to the Iowa angle of that fact that the justices ruled in Trump's favor. And this article is written by Caleb McCullough, who is, it says, Iowa GOP celebrate Trump ruling. Supreme Court states can remove Trump from ballot. The Iowa angle is this. Iowa Republican politicians celebrated the U.S. Supreme Court's Monday decision. The states cannot remove former President Donald Trump from a ballot over claims that he incited an insurrection, claiming a win for the embattled candidate who is on track to clinch the Republican nomination. The ruling overturned a decision by the Colorado Supreme Court that would have precluded Trump from appearing on the ballot in Tuesday primary election. Today's primary election. The Colorado court found that Trump was not able to appear on the ballot because of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which bars individuals who have, quote, engaged in insurrection from holding office again. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds called the Colorado decision an, quote, attempt to subvert the will, end quote, of the voters in the 2024 election in a statement Monday. Quote, the decision of who should serve as president belonged to the voters. Not only would this disenfranchise Coloradoans, but Iowans as well who believe Donald Trump is the best candidate on the ballot, Reynolds said. And she continued, frivolous attempts like this to harm the integrity of our elections should be struck down in similar fashion, end quote. Individuals and activist groups lodged lawsuits in several states challenging Trump's eligibility to be on the 2024 election ballot. They alleged that his role in inciting the January 6 insurrection, in which a mob of his supporters broke into the Capitol in an attempt to stop the legitimate certification of President Joe Biden's electoral votes, disqualified him from holding office under the 14th Amendment. In its decision on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled Congress has the sole discretion of enforcing the 14th Amendment. Because of that, state courts do not have authority to remove someone from the ballot for engaging in insurrection, the court said. The court's three liberal justices said in a concurring opinion that they agree with the central ruling, but they think the court considered more questions around the 14th Amendment than were necessary. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, who endorsed Trump before this year's caucuses, called the ruling a victory. Quote, first we won in court, now we're going to win at the ballot box. Let's bring home the biggest victory yet for President Trump this November, end quote. Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said the ruling preserved the rights of the voters to decide in the 2024 election. Quote, the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed what we all saw as brazen, unconstitutional power grab attempting to cause election interference, end quote. Kaufman said that in a written statement. He went on, the checks and balances worked against an unbalanced and unhinged effort to trash the Constitution and take away the right of people to vote in a free and fair election. The Iowa Democratic Party did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Monday. While there has been no similar challenge to Trump's ballot eligibility in Iowa, Republican lawmakers are moving to insulate him and other presidential candidates from such challenges in a proposed election bill. Among the many changes to election laws in the bill, it would dictate that a presidential candidate's ballot eligibility can only be challenged based on the legal sufficiency of the certificate of nomination. It would also remove a rule that federal candidates must sign a statement indicating that they are aware they are disqualified from holding office if they have been convicted of a felony. Republicans have said the bill will protect presidential candidates from overzealous judges, while Democrats decried it as a move to protect Trump from legitimate legal questions. Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton, the floor manager of the House bill, said the ruling affirms his argument that judges should not be deciding who is eligible to be on the ballot. Kaufman was a senior advisor to Trump's 2024 Iowa caucus campaign. Quote, I have been saying all along that it is not the job of activists on the far right or far left to pick who the party's nominees are, he said. That is the will of the voters. My friends on the other side of the aisle seem to think that activists should subvert democracy and choose who's on the ballot, end quote. Kaufman said he still thinks the provision limiting ballot challenges for presidential candidates is necessary. The language came from a proposed Secretary of State bill, and Kaufman said he wants to ensure that state law matches up with federal court precedent. Kaufman said he expects the House to vote on the bill on Tuesday. That would be today. Ernst Hinson praised the ruling. Members of Iowa's congressional delegation also celebrated the decision on Monday. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican, said the American people should decide. It's a quote in a social media post. GOP Representative Ashley Hinson, who endorsed Trump after the January caucuses, also showed her support for Trump on social media. Quote, I was proud to sign an amicus brief in support of President Trump's Colorado ballot disqualification appeal, and am glad the Supreme Court reversed this disastrous decision and stood up for American voters and our Constitution, she said. Voters decide elections, not liberal court judges, end quote.
Here's another story from the front page of the Quad City Times. Council considers ratifying city officials' appointments. Aldermen did not vote on two appointments in the fall of 2023. This article is written by Sarah Watson. The Davenport City Council will consider ratifying another fall 2023 decision, Alderman, a decision that aldermen did not previously vote on. Up for consideration on the council's agenda this cycle are two items that would ratify the mayor's appointment of Mallory Merritt as interim city administrator and Brian Heyer as interim city attorney. The items up for consideration also include pay and expectations for the positions. Mayor Mike Mattson signed an executive order November 8th to appoint Merritt as interim city administrator starting November 17th of 2023, which was former City Administrator Corey Spiegel's last day working in office. In addition to Merritt's duties as Assistant City Administrator and Chief Financial Officer, Mattson did not immediately return a call for comment. The city also entered into a Memorandum of Understanding November 8th, formalizing Merritt's appointment and settling expectations and pay. Merritt's base salary of $174,420 was kept the same, but under the agreement, she would receive a lump sum $50,000 bonus on the May 3rd payroll cycle for the extra duties. That memorandum was signed by Mattson and the five aldermen that chaired committees on council at the time. But the memorandum did not come before council in a meeting for a public vote. Now, according to City Council agenda item background, quote, the city's outside legal counsel advises that the executive order and Ms. Merritt's personnel memorandum of understanding be ratified and amendment 1 be approved by the city council, end quote. When Merritt's predecessor, Spiegel, was appointed interim city administrator in June of 2015, it came before a council for vote. It came before council for a vote. The agenda item up for consideration also includes a more recently negotiated amendment that would adjust Merritt's salary to be increased 2.5% retroactively to January 7th and agrees that Merritt will serve as interim city administrator until the city appoints someone to the position permanently. If she serves beyond April 30th as interim, the agreement states that Merritt will be paid an additional $5,000 a month. The agreement would last until November 17th, and if a permanent city administrator isn't appointed by then, Merritt and the city would negotiate a revised agreement. Merritt's appointment came after Spiegel came to a separation agreement with the city that included a $1.6 million payment for lost wages and emotional pain and suffering because of alleged harassment by elected officials. The agreement with Spiegel, signed October 6th, stipulated that Spiegel's employment with the city would end January 2nd of 2024, and she would be paid on leave from November 17th until January 2nd. The council did not vote on Spiegel's agreement in a public meeting either until 3 months after it was signed. The city council ratified it in December, also on the advice of outside counsel. The city council will also consider ratifying an executive order by Mattson appointing Heyer as the interim city attorney January 2nd. Also included would be approval of a, quote, memorandum of understanding for Heyer, dated March 13th, which would keep Heyer's salary at $123,708 and provides a lump sum bonus of $50,000 on the May 3rd payroll cycle. The council will discuss the ratifications at its 5:30 p.m. Wednesday meeting this week and take a final vote March 13th. Read more on the agenda. Mattson appointed Heyer after previous city attorney Tom Warner announced he planned to retire. The city had previously entered into an agreement with Warner in August of 2022 as part of what is called a voluntary separation insurance incentive program, offered to eligible employees, which would continue health insurance coverage for up to 12 months after an employee separated from the city. Warner signed an agreement in August of 2022, agreeing to depart the city January 2nd of 2024, according to documents released as part of a Freedom of Information request. Mattson has made 7 executive orders since September 1st, according to documents released as part of a records request by the Quad City Times, asking for any executive orders signed by Mattson in that time period. Mattson signed the 2 executive orders appointing Merritt and Heyer. The other 5 were routine recognitions for various causes. The first, Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October of 2023, and Lighting the Skybridge with Purple Lights, October 30th through November 5th. Another was World Diabetes Day in November of 2023, and Lighting the Skybridge Blue, November 13th through 19th. Also, Epilepsy Awareness Month in November of 2023, and Lighting the Skybridge Purple for the week of November 20th through 26th. And Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month was recognized, and Lighting the Skybridge Orange between February 19th and 25th. And the final one was Sudden Unexplained Death in Childhood Awareness Month, and Lighting the Skybridge Blue from March 25th through 31st.
Last article on the front page, Bee Gees visited Davenport in 1971. This story is part of a series called Timeless Tickets, where we're aiming to find the most notable concert in the Quad Cities every year from 1960 to today. If you have a story or a photo, share from an iconic local show, send it in to the entertainment reporter Gannon Hannafold at gannafold@qctimes.com. They'll get it. Disco was around the corner in the 1970s, and at the forefront of the movement will be the Bee Gees. British pop group is a trio of brothers, Barry, Robin, and Maurice Gibb. Sure, the Stayin' Alive and Saturday Night Fever disco days defined the band's peak, but they were certified soft pop stars in the early part of the decade, too. By the time they visited the Quad Cities for the first time for a show at Davenport's Masonic Temple on September 26th of 1971, the Bee Gees had charted 15 songs on the Billboard Hot 100. Just 3 months before the concert, they had their first number one, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? It was one of the biggest songs of the summer in 71. It was beautiful, by the way. Holding the top spot on the Billboard charts for the entire month of August, it wound up being one of the 5 biggest hits of the year. just behind songs by the Three Dog Night, Carole King, Rod Stewart, and the Osmonds. It finished three spots ahead of Take Me Home, Country Roads, a rural sing-along by John Denver, who also played a concert in the Quad Cities in 71. The month of their show in Davenport, the Bee Gees released their ninth studio album, Trafalgar, which also included singles like Israel and Don't Want to Live Out Inside Myself. The Bee Gees concert in Davenport landed on Sunday night, with two performances, one at 6 p.m., the other at 8:30 p.m. Tickets went for between $4 and $6. Adjusted for inflation, that would be between $30 and $45 today. Not bad. Times Democrat entertainment editor Marilyn Lane wrote a recap of the show, complete with an interview of the three brothers' father, Hugh Gibb, who worked behind the scenes in stage production for the show. Lane gave us an image of what the Gibb brothers look like on stage. Quote, Maurice wore an off-white suit and boots with a lavender shirt. Robin chose a gray suit and vest with a white shirt and black and white patent shoes. And Barry was casual in gray trousers and a vest with a navy shirt and snakeskin boots, she wrote. Well, their father boasted about their sense of style and their riches. Quote, did you see how tight Barry's trousers fit? He told Lane. Quote, they wouldn't fit anyone else. They all have Rolls Royces, too, even me, end quote. Lane asked about the fourth Gibb brother, then a 13-year-old named Andrew, and whether or not he'd ever be joined his brother, other brothers in Bee Gees. Well, he's a lot younger, and you can't expect four geniuses in the same family, the father said. It turns out Hugh undersold his own son. Andrew grew up to be better known as Andy Gibb, a two-time Grammy Award nominee in 1978 with two RIAA certified platinum albums before his death in 1988. His single, Love Is Thicker Than Water, usurped his brother's Stayin' Alive for the top spot on the Billboard Hot 100 this week in 78. And then around the Disney World, the front page story in the Times Democrat on the day of the Bee Gees' arrival in 71 was about Richard Nixon's meeting with striking workers on West Coast docks in Portland. The biggest local story was about the Iowa Hawkeyes' loss to the Penn State Nittany Lions, a team led by running back Franco Harris. Further inside the paper was a story about a new theme park opening up in Florida, Disney World. Entry prices to the park were announced as $350 for adults, and $1 for children. Today, there are four parks with park hopper tickets starting at $239. While some were excited about a new counter to Disney's theme park in Anaheim, California, the story wired in the Times Democrat focused mostly on the concern of rural Floridians. Quote, we've seen too many communities change from nice places to monstrosities, opened Charles Tyson, city manager for the Cowtown of Kissimmee, Florida. I wonder if economic progress at the price of the good life is worth it, end quote. Other significant events to take place in 71 include the release of John Lennon's Imagine, the debut of All in the Family on CBS, the death of Doors frontman Jim Morrison, and NPR's first ever broadcast. In the ensuing years, the Bee Gees rode the rocket ship of fame. Before their decline in the late 1980s, the band charted 28 more singles and 8 more number one hits, including How Deep Is Your Love, You Should Be Dancing, and Too Much Heaven. Today, Barry is the only Gibb brother alive, as Robin died in 2012 and Maurice died in 2003. Barry has stayed active, releasing a series of solo records in the late 2010s, including a country-tinged album in 2021 that featured Jason Isbell, Sheryl Crow, Miranda Lambert, and Keith Urban, all Quad Cities concert alumni. I love the Bee Gees.
I'm going to turn now to the local page of the Quad City Times. The article at the top of the page headline reads, Former DeWitt teacher sentenced to jail. He will serve 45 days in jail for sexual exploitation. The story is written by Thomas Geyer. A former Central DeWitt High School science teacher and coach, who was accused by a former student of grooming her for a sexual relationship, has been sentenced to 45 days in jail after pleading guilty to misdemeanor charges in the case. Cody David Lacoste, 38, initially was charged in Clinton County District Court with one count each, sexual exploitation of a minor, a Class C felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 10 years, and sexual exploitation by a school employee, a Class D felony that carries a prison sentence of 5 years. Lacoste also was charged with 3 counts of sexual exploitation by a school employee, each an aggravated misdemeanor that carry a prison sentence of 2 years. According to the arrest affidavits and search warrants filed by DeWitt Police Officer Justin Witt on March 2nd of 2022, a former Central DeWitt High School student reported to police that Lacoste had groomed her and had a sexual relationship with her while she was a student. The victim feared that Lacoste could be targeting and grooming other students in his current teaching position. Lacoste was working for Regina Catholic High School in Iowa City at the time of his arrest on the allegations. During the investigation, the victim reported to DeWitt Police that in the spring of 2017, while she was still a minor and student at Central DeWitt, Lacoste started a sexual relationship with her. The sex acts occurred in Lacoste's office on school grounds. The victim also provided police with direct messages sent by Lacoste to the victim over Twitter that were of a sexual nature and seemed to corroborate the victim's accusations. Police subpoenaed Lacoste's Twitter records. According to its search warrant on October 5th of 2022, he set up an interview with Lacoste, which eventually was declined. Later, on October 5th, the victim reported to Officer Witt that Lacoste had contacted her asking if she had said anything. The victim provided Officer Witt with a screenshot of the conversation with Lacoste's cell phone number. The victim also provided Officer Witt with a picture that Lacoste had sent her from his phone on June 3rd of 2022, indicating a continuance of sexually suggestive communication with the victim. Lacoste was arrested March 21, 2023. In a plea agreement filed in Clinton County District Court, Lacoste pleaded guilty to the 3 counts of sexual exploitation by a school employee. The felony charges were dismissed in the agreement. During a sentencing hearing held February 22nd in Clinton County District Court, District Associate Judge Kimberly Shepherd sentenced Lacoste to 45 days in the Clinton County Jail on each count, with the sentences to run concurrently or at the same time. Lacoste also was ordered to pay a fine of $855 on each count. Lacoste will be under the jurisdiction of the Iowa Department of Corrections for 10 years and shall be supervised as though he is on parole. He already has registered on the Iowa Sex Offender Registry.
Staying on page 3, IDN celebrates 30th anniversary. Donor Network has provided support to over 16,000 families. Gretchen Teske wrote this article, very short. The Iowa Donor Network, IDN, announced its 30th anniversary, marking 3 decades of dedication to inspiring organ, tissue, and eye donation across the state of Iowa. Since its inception in 1994, IDN has been at the forefront of facilitating life-saving donations and supporting donor families. To commemorate this significant milestone, IDN shared the profound impact it has had over the past 30 years. Through more than 1,900 organ donors, IDN has facilitated the transplantation of more than 6,000 life-saving organs. Through more than 15,000 tissue donors, each of whom gave an average of 75 tissues for transplant, more than 1 million people have been helped. Additionally, IDN has provided compassionate support to over 16,000 donor families during and after the donation process. We are incredibly grateful to have reached this remarkable milestone, Suzanne Conrad, CEO at Iowa Donor Network, said. And she continued, for 30 years, our dedicated team and supporters have worked tirelessly to inspire hope and transfer lives through the gift of donation. Each donor and each family served residents a story of compassion and generosity, end quote. For more information about Iowa Donor Network and its 30th anniversary celebration, please visit iowadonornetwork.org. I'm going to read this story here, too. It's on this same page. Let's see if I can get through this. I think it's called Quesatacos, a tacos al vapor food truck, written by Ganna Hanovold. One of the first things I noticed after moving to the Quad Cities was the impressive food truck scene. There's a massive variety of cuisines that trucks around the Quad Cities, and I'm eager to try as many as I can when the spring and summer make it easier to get out. Thankfully, I haven't had to wait as long as expected for good weather. Last week blessed us with beautiful highs, and on Friday afternoon, I took that as a hint that I ought to get outside and try a food truck. Searching around on a few Facebook foodie groups, I found one that caught my eye, Tacos Al Vapor, a truck in Moline that's only open a few days a week. The hard part with finding a truck, food truck, is knowing exactly where they'll be. Many have changing schedules or fluctuating websites, but Tacos Al Vapor updates their page almost daily. So with food images that piqued my interest and an exact address of where to find them, away I went. On that day, Tacos Al Vapor was located outside of Video Games, etc. in Moline. I'm not a huge gamer, but I am a fanatic eater, so I hoped to find a meal that felt like a boss battle. The dish, Casa Tacos, the menu at Tacos Al Vapor has a lot of typical taco truck fare, street tacos, burritos, a variety of grilled meats, rice and beans, and E-L-O-T-E, I think that's elote. But there also are a few menu items that caught my eye as novelties. Quesadilla pizza, fried cactus, and cabeza, cowhead, to name a few. According to their website, past rotating offerings have included fish tacos, hot Cheeto burritos, and intestines. Well, but what stood out most to me was the subject of the photo that initially sparked my interest on Facebook, Quesatacos. I'm no Spanish etymologist, but the quesatacos are exactly what they sound like. Tacos with a whole lot of cheese. Cheese tacos, maybe that's how it's pronounced. The corn tortillas are dipped in red enchilada sauce, coated in melted cheese. Then they're stuffed with the typical street taco ingredients. Cilantro, onion, and consomme. And while Tacos Al Vapor's regular tacos have multiple options for meat, the quesatacos are all served with juicy barbacoa. I'm running into some trouble here, so I'm going to go ahead. The location, the only gripe I have about this is that they're not around more often, though I'm hoping with a little bit of word of mouth we can change that. For the winter season, they're open from 12 to 7 p.m. on Thursdays on Quad Cities campus of Western Illinois University. On Fridays and Saturdays, they're located outside Video Games, etc., 4241 Avenue of the Cities in Moline. Tacos Al Vapor is closed Sunday through Wednesday. If you're looking to pair your visit with an activity, there are bowling lanes right across the street from their Friday and Saturday spot, and Aldi and Hy-Vee grocery stores are right there too, if you want to stop for a bite before your shopping. The ambiance, the great thing about Tacos Al Vapor, I hope that's pronounced right, is that you can call ahead to place your order, and they also hand out a buzzer if you order at the window and need to walk somewhere while you wait for it to be done. During business hours, that's a lifesaver. But during my visit around 1 p.m. on Friday, it was quite enough to where I couldn't get too far. Tacos Al Vapor appears to be beloved by those who know about it. Their posts on Facebook often get a few dozen shares when new menu items are announced and reintroduced. One call-ahead customer who waited for her order near me said she's lived in multiple cities across the U.S. and their chicken burrito is the best she's ever had. I know what I'll be trying next time I stop by.
Sounds good. As a program note, you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And we will now turn to the obituaries from the Quad City Times. There are two here. The first is Robert Earl Gully, and he was born December 18th of 1931 and passed away February 28th of 2024. The morning of Wednesday, February 28th, saw the sweet and gentle spirit of Bob Gully quietly slip away from this world. He was 92. Bob was born at home on December 18th, 1931, in Thompsonville, Illinois, the third of seven children born to Lawrence and Josephine Gully. When times were tough, his father took Bobby and his older brother Charles out of school and pointed them to the Quad Cities to find work. Bob's work life began at J.I. Case and took him through many of the local factories. It was a Rock Island Millworks that he discovered a love and talent for carpentry. Bob had a head for numbers and measures and angles. He could visualize a completed project with great ease, and he had the skills to execute his vision. His work life culminated in 15 years as a Finnish carpenter and high-end woodworker at the Rock Island Arsenal. His replica of Colonel George Davenport's home is on display at the Arsenal Museum. After a brief courtship, Bob married Donna, maiden name Harris, in April of 1953 in Piggott, Arkansas. Donna's perpetual motion engaged her in many activities, for example, Corn Belt Running Club and Habitat for Humanity, and Bob supported her in everything she did. He attended her races, built display cases for her many running trophies, and lent his carpentering skills to Habitat builds, just to name a few. Donna was always the healthy one, always the caregiver, but when she was tragically stricken with a debilitating illness, Bob doted on her tenderly through her final days. Though rugged as any young fellow, Bobby was first and always a mama's boy. He was just 41 when he lost mommy to cancer. His heartbreak never fully subsided. Throughout his life, he would tear up when speaking of her. Bobby shared his mother's warm and loving nature, and he grew into a kind and loving man. He was generous with his family, but his giving ways extended to friends, neighbors, co-workers, and even strangers. If he knew someone was in need, he was unable to resist helping. He was also quite gregarious, enjoying meeting new people, and could happily engage in conversation with virtually anyone. These traits, along with his ready smile, his quick and deliciously dry wit, and his mellow manner, earned Bob the moniker Good Gully. Even as he fought the slings and arrows of aging, including the loss of his beloved Donna May, he remained an essentially happy man. His love of people provided him with ample opportunities for humorous banter wherever he went. In the years following Donna's death, Bob had the great good fortune of his nephew, George Fortner, whose care made Bob healthier, more independent, more engaged, and enhanced his life in every way. No prayer could supply a better guardian angel, and no family could be more grateful for a nephew's loving kindness. The family is also deeply thankful for the extraordinary care provided Bob by the staff of Fort Armstrong, who showed him such genuine love. Generous to the end, Bob donated his body to the University of Iowa Medical Center. According to his wishes, his ashes will be interred with Donna at Farlow Grove Cemetery in Matherville, and there will be no funeral. The family will announce a celebration of his life in the near future. Wieland Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan is assisting with arrangements. Those wishing to remember Bob with a donation can give to Fort Armstrong Assisted Living, 1900 3rd Avenue, Rock Island, 61201. Bob Gully was as likable a man as one is apt to meet. People were drawn to him, quickly feeling accepted and validated by his easy manner and open heart. His life proved the truth of Maya Angelou's wisdom that, quote, "People will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel," end quote. Bob made people feel good, and for this he will be remembered. And the second obituary is for Harold L. Schwertfeger, Jr., age 89, of Davenport, who passed away Saturday, March 2nd, at Davenport Lutheran Home. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 7th, at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Bettendorf. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be at Oakdale Memorial Gardens, and memorials may be directed to the family. Harold was born March 5th, 1934, in West Liberty, Iowa, to Harold and Margaret Enderly Schwertfeger, Sr. On July 5th, 1952, he married Shirley Hildebrand in Bettendorf. In 1973, they moved to Southern California, where Harold worked for Rod's Food Products in Industry, California. In 1994, they returned to the Quad Cities. Over the years, Harold worked for various companies, including Bettendorf Company, Oscar Mayer, and two Western stores in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He also served as assistant fire chief in Ridgeview. Online condolences may be shared at the website McGinnis-Chambers.com.
Okay, moving on to the opinion section of the Quad City Times. This one is written by, or it's another view, Los Angeles Times. Public needs, spelled K-N-E-A-D-S. Public needs some answers on $20 wage. Did Panera Bread get an exemption because of campaign dough to California's governor? And it reads, even before California Governor Newsom signed the landmark law in September that would increase the minimum wage for fast food workers to $20 per hour starting in April, eyebrows were raised over the so-called Panera exception. The law was designed to boost pay and improve working conditions for employees of fast food chain restaurants, but it contained an oddly specific carve-out. It wouldn't apply to restaurants that bake and sell bread as a standalone item on the menu. Now, Bloomberg reports that Newsom pushed behind the scenes for the exemption, which will benefit billionaire Greg Flynn, a campaign donor and business associate who owns two dozen Panera Bread locations in the state. Flynn runs one of the world's largest restaurant franchise operations and was a vocal opponent of the law, which sets a fast food worker wage and creates a fast food council that would hike pay in future years and develop labor, health, and safety standards for the covered restaurants. Flynn, who also attended the same high school as Newsom, contributed $160,000 combined to the governor's 2021 anti-recall campaign and his 2022 reelection. That's a lot of dough, D-O-U-G-H. When questioned about the bread exemption last year, Newsom dismissed it as, quote, part of the sausage making, end quote, of politics amid rising outrage last week. Newsom's office put out a statement calling the Bloomberg story absurd and suggesting Panera is not exempt from the law because it mixes the dough at an off-site location and only bakes and sells the bread at the restaurant. Okay, but we're going to need some proof because the carving out for bakeries has been reported numerous times using Panera as the example of a restaurant that would benefit from the exemption. The governor's office has yet to explain publicly why the bakery exemption was even warranted. And Assemblymember Chris Holden, Democrat, Pasadena, who carried the bill, said he had nothing to do with devising the bread break. Newsom and legislative leaders need to explain themselves. This sounds exactly like the kind of legislative shenanigans that undermine public confidence. Lawmakers should expect to explain why an exemption from any new law is necessary. But it's difficult to imagine how this one could be justified. How does it make sense that if a restaurant bakes bread for sandwiches, its workers deserve $20 an hour, but if it sells it as a loaf, its workers don't? If you were thinking, well, why doesn't McDonald's just start selling the McBaguette in California to avoid the law? The exemption applies only to restaurants that operate on-site bakeries as of September 15, 2023. This is really a half-baked idea anyway. Anyone who works for Panera or another exempted chain restaurant bakery can easily switch to another eatery that pays the new minimum wage. This idea is so crumbly, it could have risen only in Sacramento.
That was a tough one to read. There is a political cartoon today drawn by Andy Marlette, and it's going to take a little bit of describing. The top of the picture shows a banner that reads American Pie. That's the description of the whole drawing. There are two easels, and on each easel is a pie chart, a round circle broken up into pieces of the pie to show who, which portion of the pie was given to each subject. Anyway, and on the right-hand side, we have a Republican elephant pointing to the pie chart and talking about what it reads. And on the left-hand side, we have a donkey for the Democrats showing what their pie chart says. So the elephant on the right, his pie chart or her pie chart, it's got a bow tie, but I don't know whether it's a man or woman elephant. Anyway, this pie chart has one very big section, which is about 60% of it, more than half of it, that says Trump is God. And this is apparently how the voters are expected to vote, according to this Republican elephant. So Trump is God, earning about 2/3 of the pie in this vote. The next largest section is for Nikki Haley. It's probably less than a quarter of it, about 20%. And then three smaller portions, about 10% or less. One of them goes to the F-bomb. It, let's drop out and move to Costa Rica. Another one goes to Kennedy, and the smallest slice goes to Sanity. So that's the Republican pie chart indicating where their voters are going to go. The Democratic donkey is pointing them to a pie chart that has most of it, about 3/4 of it, about 75% of the pie going to anyone, dear God, anyone but Trump. And then it's got four smaller sections. They're fairly equal between Taylor Swift, Kennedy, and Biden's too old. Each of those are probably around 10% or less. And the very smallest portion of the pie chart goes to protest votes. So that's what Andy Martlett thinks in terms of the American voting public and where they may go. Here is the next opinion. It's written by Kathleen Parker, and the headline says, Clinton was half right about vast right-wing conspiracy. When then First Lady Hillary Clinton first mentioned a, quote, vast right-wing conspiracy, the enemy factions, in other words, the Republicans that she said were out to get her husband, she was half right. They were out to get him. What she didn't acknowledge was that Bill Clinton had it coming once he'd fouled the people's house with behavior unbefitting a housebroke dog. Yet how nearly quaint his relatively boyish escapades seem today compared with former President Donald Trump's X-rated engagement with a porn star while wife Melania was recovering from childbirth. I suppose one could point out that Trump's brief encounter during a golf tournament happened before he became president, while Clinton abused a young employee in the Oval Office in clear violation of workplace law. And then one could run to the loo and retch. Funny, we haven't heard Melania blame a vast left-wing conspiracy for trying to get rid of her husband. Perhaps if there were such an operation, she'd sign up. Take a number, honey. But the conspiracy afoot now is vast and right-wing, and the grand conspirator is Trump. If he said day is night, his followers would put themselves to bed while the sun was shining. Through fakery and fraud, he has created a force field around himself that protects him from consequences and lulls supporters into a trance. If Trump doesn't like a negative report about him, it's, quote, fake news. If he says the 2020 election was, quote, stolen from him, it must be so. If prosecutors charge him with inciting the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol, it's a conspiracy. Even the U.S. Supreme Court seems to have fallen under his spell. The justices announced recently they'll review Trump's claim that he is protected from prosecution for actions while he was in office. Actually, we already know what happened there. This means his federal trial on charges... This means his federal trial on charges of conspiring to overturn the 2020 election results will be postponed, possibly through the election. Arguments are scheduled for the week of April 22nd. At issue is a unanimous ruling from a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit that rejected Trump's claim of immunity from prosecution. Let me repeat, unanimous. What happened to no one is above the law, including the President of the United States. The court's unsigned order said the justices weren't, quote, expressing a view on the merits, end quote, and would consider only whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office, end quote. Had Trump gone to trial as originally planned, and if he had been found guilty, voters would know the results before the election. Now that his nomination is all but in the bag, he could conceivably be elected president and then have to face trial. Assuming, that is, the High Court rules that his presidency does not shield him from prosecution. The soonest we'll know could be May or June. Then the court adjourns for the summer, after which a criminal trial could take months to get back on the docket. In the meantime, Trump can set aside a case that would have consumed much of his time and kept him away from the campaign trail. My brain can't compute what might transpire should Trump be elected and then, while president, sit through a trial. He faces four felony counts related to the alleged plan to overturn the election: conspiracy to obstruct congressional certification of the Biden victory, obstructing a congressional proceeding, conspiring to defraud the United States, and conspiracy against the right to vote. Based on everything we know from multiple investigations, it seems more likely than not that a jury would find Trump guilty on all counts. The evidence is overwhelming that he watched the protesters breach the Capitol for 187 minutes, ignoring urgent pleas to intervene from advisors, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, and Trump's own daughter, Ivanka. By the time he told the crowd to stand down, the first two of five people were dead. It would seem that the true Teflon candidate, once Clinton's nickname, is Trump. Teflon Trump. When he once said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still love him, he wasn't joking. Such an event is unlikely, and surely presidential immunity wouldn't apply to an act of lethal violence. But what if, as promised last November, a re-elected President Trump weaponized the FBI and the Justice Department to punish political opponents? This sounds like a conspiracy to me, the vast implications of which Russian President Vladimir Putin and today's Republican Party would applaud. God help us. And again, that was an opinion from Kathleen Parker, who writes for the Washington Post.
I'm moving to page 3 of the sports section here. Just to quickly state that the Class 3A Iowa High School Athletic State Tournament, number 4 Davenport Assumption versus number 5 Ballard. Number 4 Assumption, 16-8, takes on number 5 Ballard, 16-8. In tonight's, or rather this afternoon's, 3:45 game, IHSAA Class 3A State Quarterfinal game at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. That is this afternoon. Up next, the winner faces either number 1 Decorah, which is 22-2, or number 8 Williamsburg, which is 16-8, in Thursday's 2 p.m. semifinal back at Wells Fargo Arena. Assumption comes into the state tournament averaging 62.8 points per game and allowing 55.3. Ballard averages 62.4 points and allows 53. Assumption averages 29.4 rebounds per game, while the Bombers average 33. And a little tournament history. This is Assumption's 19th state trip, including back-to-back appearances in 2021 and 2022. The Knights, who have a 23-17 record at state, have three titles, 2000, 1999, and 1982. Ballard is in its 12th quarterfinal trip, the last of those coming in 2021 when the Bombers were state runner-up. They are 7-14 in those appearances. So that's just a little bit on that game that's going on this afternoon. Here's a short article on Clark earning weekly Big Ten award again. It's written by Dave Silver. Caitlin Clark was named the Big Ten Player of the Week for 29th time in her career and 11th time this season. Clark had a triple-double against Minnesota on Wednesday, 33-12-10, before scoring 35 points on Sunday against number 2 Ohio State. In the game against the Buckeyes, Clark surpassed Pete Maravich as the all-time leading scorer in NCAA history. Clark has 3,685 points, 18 more than Maravich. Also on Monday, Clark was named a finalist for the Nancy Lieberman Award as the top point guard in college basketball. Clark won the award last year and was a finalist as a freshman and sophomore. For the season, Clark is averaging 32.2 points, 8.7 assists, and 7.7 rebounds per game. The 26-4 Hawkeyes ranked number 3 in the latest AP Top 25 poll released Monday, face either Wisconsin 13-15, or Penn State 18-11 in the quarterfinals of the sold-out Big Ten tournament on Friday at the Target Center in Minneapolis. The game will be broadcast on the Big Ten Network. And there's a picture here in this article of guess who, Caitlin Clark, number 22, shooting one of her shots. And the article continues, Hawkeyes are hopeful Davis returns. Iowa head coach Lisa Bluter said Monday that senior guard Molly Davis will return at home or at some point in the postseason. The 5'7 guard from Midland, Michigan, suffered a right knee injury in the first half of Sunday's game against Ohio State. She was carried off the floor and returned for senior day activities after the game in a wheelchair. Quote, while we feel for Molly that she got injured during senior day, we are so thankful that the injury she sustained is not season-ending, Bluter said. Our program has appreciated everyone's support and prayers as we look forward to her return at some point during the postseason. Davis averages 6.1 points and 3.1 assists per game. Her assist-to-turnover ratio of plus 2.51 is team-leading. Dale?
I'll tell you a little bit more about what's going on in prep boys basketball. I may not get through the whole article before we need to wrap up, but Thompson breaking into important role for Knights. This is written by Tom Johnston. No matter the endeavor, everyone can use a break every now and then to help them succeed. There is a distinct possibility that Braylon Thompson may have twisted that take a little bit. The Davenport Assumption High School junior has endured a couple of breaks this basketball season, but they have not been ones that any athlete wants to deal with. Just as the season was getting started with workouts, the 17-year-old said he was at the Y getting in some work when he broke his left ankle. Then, right after the turn of the calendar to 2024, his bad luck continued. We were playing Cedar Falls at the Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids, and on the first play of the game, he drove the baseline and went up for layup and was fouled. This is what Assumption coach Joe Ewan recalled of another fateful moment. Thompson tried catching himself as he fell to the floor and ended up fracturing a bone in his left wrist. Thompson said that it was the second time he has broken that wrist. He reported that he broke his right foot when he was in junior high. I must be pretty injury-prone, said Thompson with a smile. I just have bad luck, I guess. Despite those two most recent injuries, Thompson has missed just one game this season and helped the Knights reach this week's Class 3A state tournament in Des Moines. The ankle wasn't that serious, just a crack, said Thompson. My wrist, I kind of got lucky. I was in a cast, but that was when we had all that bad weather and like 3 or 4 games got delayed, and I was lucky to only miss one game. Thompson credited the training staff at Assumption and those at ORA who helped him get back on the court. We expect you to give everything you've got, joked Ewan of players offering up limb, if not life, to the program. It was a testament to Braylon. With that, he's embraced what it takes to get back ahead of schedule and get into the training room and get back to help his team out. He knew we needed him. By no means do we want him to risk further injury, But he took rehab serious and attacked it with everything he could and got back to his teammates as quickly as he could. Being as healthy as he has been all season, Thompson has been a key figure in helping the Knights reach Tuesday's 3:45 state quarterfinal against Ballard High School at Wells Fargo in Des Moines. The solidly built 6'5" wing comes into the game averaging 9 points, 3.3 rebounds, and 1.8 assists per game. But more than his numbers, Thompson, the grandson of former Riverdale High School coach Don Thompson, brings the intangibles to the court that make him more valuable. I'll skip down to the end of this story here. And here's a quote. "He really is a big part of our mismatch problems because he's so hard to guard. While he still tapes his left wrist, the non-shooting wrist, to protect it, Thompson has once again become a major contributor for the Knights. Getting over those bumps, bruises, and breaks has made the work and anguish worth it. Most people know junior year is pretty critical when it comes to deciding college and all that," said Thompson, who is still undecided about his future college hoops plans. "It just happened at the time it did. I knew it was going to suck, but I had to get back and help us to where we are now." And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.